We chose renewal as the theme for March for a reason. Most religious calendars are intimately in sync with the seasons, one way or another. The Jewish holiday of Passover had its origins in the spring harvest of barley, and that set the date for Easter, the Christian celebration of renewal and rebirth. I left the picture up this morning. There's a black and white copy of it on the order of service, but I thought, looking at it this morning, that could have been our meditation. If I could capture in a few words in the sermon what I want to say about renewal, that picture speaks volumes. I've been sharing with some of you my desire to celebrate as an annual ritual the renewal of maple syrup, maple syrup season in Nova Scotia. I'm serious about this. The Mi'kmaq people of this land recognized the rising of the maple sap and the sweet water, as they called it, as the renewal of life. I understand they didn't make syrup with it, but they cooked meat in it. They cooked vegetables in it, and the sap gave that sweetness to the meat and vegetables. It seems to me to be the perfect sign of spring in this part of the world and a cause to celebrate the renewal of that great cosmic cycle. For thousands of years, humanity has celebrated these cosmic cycles. The working of the cosmos has been reset to the beginning with every cycle. But the culture that we live in today is not satisfied with the idea of renewal as a return to a starting process and a cyclical process. Our culture is one that looks for continual progress. So the idea of renewal takes us beyond the idea of returning to a previous state. It includes the idea of making a fresh start that will take one to the next level of advancement. We speak of renewing our efforts to overcome poverty or disease, not with an intention to return to some previous state, but rather to achieve new levels of accomplishment. Renewal in a religious sense is often seen as something that happens on a personal level. In our secular world, we celebrate the weekend as a time of renewal. And the idea of a weekend is a very old idea of taking time in a cyclic basis for rest and renewal. 7-day week evolved in the ancient Middle East and became intimately connected with the Jewish religion and the observance of Shabbat, or Sabbath, as a time of personal renewal. In Marcia Falk's The Book of Blessings, she writes, "In an ideal world, we might be aware of the potential for holiness at every moment of every day. Yet in the real world, the business of life and the busyness of life often seems to distract us from our most profound connections. Shabbat returns a sense of balance. It helps us to regain our perspective. It's an opportunity for pause. Step back from our occupation with the world and to appreciate instead our very being in the world." In the early 20th century, trade unions in North America struggled to have the weekend, Saturday and Sunday, recognized as a time of rest, as a way to accommodate both the Jewish Sabbath, the Jewish Shabbat, and the Christian Sunday. And that battle was won, and the idea of the weekend then spread around the world. As the title of today's sermon and the picture above suggests, there are limits to personal renewal, although we sometimes live as if that wasn't the case. There was a wake-up call for me the other day when I opened the paper and looked at the business section, and there was an article about United Airlines. I don't know whether it caught anybody. I mean, anybody else's eyes. I'd like to quote from it here. It's talking about what's going on at United Airlines and all the financial turmoil they're going through. It said, "The battle of the board comes just as Chief Executive Officer Oscar Munoz returned from medical leave. Munoz became the CEO in October of last year, after United dismissed Jeff Smyzik amid a federal investigation. Munoz quickly brought some fresh air to the company, taking responsibility for the troubled integration promising to make the immediate changes and making employees and passengers happier. However, he suffered a heart attack on October the 15th. And he had a heart transplant in January. And he's scheduled to get back to work full-time on Monday. A move welcomed by Wall Street. How's that for personal renewal? Of course, Dick Cheney, the former Vice President of the United States, had a heart transplant in 2012 at the age of 71. It caused some controversy. Is it just me, or are those facts kind of amazing? When I read something like that, I think of a friend who, every time he gets a new piece of technology or something like this comes along, he likes to say, "Man, I love living in the future." So that picture on the order of service this morning was selected to speak to you of renewal on a different scale. There are limits for renewal for any individual. If nothing else, we're limited by our mortality, by the certainty of our own death. Faced with the limits of personal renewal, we can be encouraged by the opportunities for institutional and societal renewal. I've been thinking a lot about the future of the church in general and the future of Unitarian Universalism in particular. Clearly, religion in North America and in Europe has been going through a dramatic change. What church means now is being rethought, reinterpreted. Perhaps in order to visualize the future of our faith tradition, it might be helpful to imagine a kind of return to an earlier state, a state 2,000 years ago, when religion, philosophy, and science were not all separate pursuits, but were intertwined endeavors. I think about the future of Unitarian Universalism in that light. Philosophy is part of our faith as it relates to how we live a good life. Science is part of our faith for its dedication to truth and its rejection of irrational and superstitious beliefs. And religion is part of our faith for the exploration of the questions of why and our search for ultimate meaning in our lives. Religion in general seems to have a hard time with the idea of renewal. It's apparently a natural part of being human that we long for some form of renewal that will ensure our continuation beyond the grave, some afterlife in a state referred to as heaven, or maybe reincarnation and rebirth. And I don't rule out either of those possibilities. But I do feel strongly that to view renewal in such personal terms misses the single most important way that we can give meaning to our lives. We can give meaning to our lives in the most profound way when we see ourselves not as isolated individuals, but as part of a grand process. I walked into the offices of the blood collection services last week. And like most here, I suspect I don't particularly enjoy this process, having blood drawn. But in the hands of a skilled phlebotomist, it's nothing more than a slight inconvenience. When they finally called my number and I was ushered into the operating room, I knew this was going to be a slightly different experience. The phlebotomist who politely asked me to roll up my sleeve was very young and obviously new at the job. I was only mildly comforted by the fact that an older, more experienced lady was sitting on a stool in the room giving her step-by-step instructions. "Do you think you can get that vein?" "Oh yeah, give it a try." I immediately thought of my upcoming sermon. See, this was a perfect case of renewal. The older, experienced phlebotomist was passing on her knowledge to the next generation. My enthusiasm for the process of renewal was slightly dampened by the painful reality of training a phlebotomist with my personal blood vessels. When it was over, I told both the teacher and the pupil that they would be in my next sermon to be titled, "The Pain of Renewal." teaching, older teaching younger, passing things on, is surely the most important form of renewal that we can participate in. The renewal that comes with raising children and passing on our knowledge and our training to our children and our youth to take place and hopefully exceed what we've been able to accomplish. I learned something else about renewal this week. Rabbi Ellis, a friend of this congregation, asked me to write a brief biographical introduction for him, for a program that he'd been asked to speak at. It seemed kind of strange. I know that Rabbi Ellis has done this kind of thing many times, and he certainly must have a bio laying around that he could have used or written a fresh one if he needed it. So my curiosity got me doing a little bit of research online, and I found that there's a tradition in the Jewish faith of discouraging the writing of autobiographies. Jewish autobiographies, the idea of Jewish autobiographies is a relatively new thing from the 19th century primarily. Rabbi Ellis later described it as a tradition of saying little and doing much, a tradition that discourages puffing up the ego. So I digress here slightly, I know, but I found a line in an absorbing document titled The Life of Yehuda that scholars have long considered to be in the grand Jewish autobiographical tradition. This was as far as a Jew at the time would go in writing an autobiography. It goes like this. This is the life story of Judah Arya. Few and evil have been the days of my life in this world. On Monday, the 28th day of Nisan, corresponding with the 23rd day of April, between the 18th and 19th hour, I was born on this date. I, the bitter and impetuous, was born. I, almost like Job and Jeremiah, would curse that day. For why did I go out of the womb and witness all the anger and strife and toil and trouble, only evil continually? My mother experienced great difficulty in childbirth. I was born in the breech position. My buttocks turned outward facing, so that the calamities turned upon me even at the beginning. So wrote Leon Yehuda Arya of Modena, who was a recognized Jewish intellect figure in Renaissance Italy. I suggested to Rabbi Ellis that this might be an interesting way to introduce him, if I simply change the dates and the names. As I read about the dearth of Jewish autobiographies, I learned about the Jewish tradition of ethical wills, which is a way of kind of replacing the idea, turning the idea of autobiography on its head. The early rabbis urged men to transmit the traditions of their ethical teachings, and they communicated orally with their sons, and later these traditions were written into letters. Medieval ethical wills contained the directions of fathers to their children or aged teachers to their disciples. This is clearly patriarchal, no, but it was the time, this was the tradition at the time. These were often written calmly in an old age. Some of them were carefully composed and read as formal ethical treaties. But most were written in a personal writing style and were intended for the private use of children and relatives, or of some beloved pupil that held a special place in the teacher's regard. Because they were not designed for publication, they often revealed the writer's innermost feelings and ideals. The earliest still existent ethical will was written by Eleazar about 1050. He wrote, "Think not evil, for evil thinking leads to evil doing. Purify thy body, the dwelling place of thy soul. Give of all thy food a portion to God, let God's portion be the best. And give it to the poor." Eliezer spoke of the renewing power of good literature. Or pardon me, the renewing power of good literature was spoken about in his second ethical will, written by Judah ben Saul, about 1190. Avoid bad society, Make thy books thy companions, lest the bookcases and shelves be the garden and pleasure and your pleasure ground. Pluck the fruit that grows therein, gather the roses, spices, and the myrrh. If thy soul be satiate and weary, change from garden to garden and from furrow to furrow and from sight to sight. Then will thy desire renew itself and thy soul be satisfied with delight. So the idea of an ethical will speaks directly to the need to renew our highest aspirations in each new generation. An ethical will, written as it is, to be read about after the author's death, is a recognition that we cannot compel the thoughts of the next generation, only offer what we have learned to be true in our lives. In the words of Khalil Gibran, we may give our children our love, but not our thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. We may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow. A place we cannot visit, not even in our dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you, for life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. So I want to close with some thoughts about our own religious exploration program for children, what we do here at the church, as a basis for our institutional renewal. One of the things that attracted me to serve this congregation when I came here in 2012 was the commitment the congregation had made to our religious exploration program for children and youth. The idea that we would hire a part-time religious exploration director. It's been over 3 years since we embarked on that program of renewal for our religious exploration program. And we've had some success and some setbacks. No one said it was going to be easy. It's exciting for us every time a new family comes to a Sunday service, and I think we all share the hope that we can meet their needs and that our community can offer some accumulated wisdom to the young family and to the children. A dynamic, open, and inviting religious exploration program for children and youth is essentially an invitation to take part in the renewal that transcends our own human lifespan. As a volunteer teacher in the RE programs, you have the opportunity to give meaning to your life in a very significant way. The love and guidance and education that we provide for the generations that will follow us remains the most important work that we can do. A task of renewal that can give our lives meaning. So may we renew our efforts to make our aspirations for religious exploration for our children a reality. Might be so.